Death is not the end. Death can never be the end. Death is a road. Life is the traveler. The soul is the guide.
Forming, our hearts are unfolding. Beauty is breaking right through the dawn. All loving, all knowing, all giving and growing. This life ever changing within the song. Oh Father, oh Mother, oh friend and oh lover, life wonderful. Release us, protect us, challenge us, guide us through all and all. And the love grows when the light moves between you and me. Gotta shine that light, make ourselves free. Morning is coming, there's a warm breeze blowing, and the birds sing a tune with the melody. All hearts are ascending, all brokenness mending, and strangers and friends are as family. Oh Father, oh Mother, oh friend and oh lover, life wonderful. Release us, protect us, challenge us, guide us through all and all. And the love grows when the light moves between you and me. Gotta shine that light and make ourselves free. Comes the dawn with every day. Make a smile and share it. Give it away, brighten up a cloudy day. Shine a light and share it. Bring on the day, comes the dawn with every day. Make a smile and share it. Give it away, brighten up a cloudy day. Shine a light and share it. Bring on the day. Bring on the day.
To worship this morning comes from a 9th century Chinese poet and recluse by the name of Han Shan. A telling analogy for life and death. Compare the two of them to ice and water. Water draws together to become ice, and ice disperses again to become water. Whatever has died is sure to be born again. Whatever is born comes around again to dying. As ice and water do one another no harm, so life and death, the two of them, are fine. Come, let us worship together.
Like the woman peering fearfully into the dark doorway filled with many spiders, many of us are frightened and confused by our first meeting with death. But then in a typical life, the door swings closed and we go on about the work of living. The older we get, the more the door swings open again. In time, perhaps we begin to wonder, just what is behind that door? What might we who are living be able to learn about death? What can our knowledge about death teach us about life? These are among the questions we're considering today, thanks to Gene Weninger, who selected this theme as the winner of the annual opportunity to select a topic for a sermon at our last auction of goods and services. Many of us hold these questions for times when loss comes. That's mostly what I have done in my own life. I engage with death when death comes, and in the holidays and holy days that direct my attention to endings, like Halloween, All Souls Day, and Day of the Dead. In those times, death is often woven so thoroughly with grief that they seem inseparable. But Jean's question somehow prompted me to take a different approach. I know that there are surely some among us who are grieving this morning, grieving some loss that's tender to us. And yet, if death is not near for us, this season outside does not speak to us of death, does not speak to us of loss. The bright blooming flowers, blossoming trees, and sprouting gardens all call us to revel in the freshness of spring, in the unfolding of life, in newness. So maybe this morning, on a beautiful sunny day, maybe today, in the midst of spring, could be a good time for us to consider death in a new light. Maybe in this warm light, we can see in ways that are not so easy to see through the veil of tears. That's sort of the idea behind a new movement that's quickly gaining traction around the world called death cafes. Have you heard of them? I've never heard of them. Death cafes are open conversations about death that take place in a comfortable community setting like a coffee shop or some kind of community center, while participants enjoy tea and delicious cakes. In fact, that's a requirement if you're going to host a death cafe. You have to serve tea and delicious cakes. The first death cafe was held in England just 2 years ago. Since then, over 100 cafes have been held all across England, Wales, the United States, Canada, and Australia. Some of the people who are drawn to these cafes are grieving or are anticipating a loss, but very many more go just because they're curious. They have ideas they'd like to share about death, questions to explore, and wonderments to express. They believe that by talking more openly and authentically about death, they can learn more fully how to be alive. That's the message that I get from Wendell Berry's poem that I shared with you earlier. Judy Brandon captured that poem perfectly, I think, on the cover of your order of service. No, no, there is no going back. Less and less you are that possibility that you were. More and more you have become those lives and deaths that belong to you. To use that word death to describe our losses may not literally work for you, but I think that the metaphor resonates. Sometimes there are endings in our lives that are full, clear, complete stops. Even in the midst of a particular loss, sometimes we know that that loss has changed us. We have changed. We'll never be the same again. This morning, we will look at this through the lens of three mortalities. Let's start with spiritual death. When I consider the phrase spiritual death, the first experience that comes to mind is not my own. It's the experience of a good friend of mine and one that I've since heard echoed by several people. This friend of mine grew up in a family and in a religious community which taught that the Bible is the literal word of God. As a child, my friend accepted this teaching. As a young adult, though, he began to have questions. And his questioning led to study, which led to more study, which ultimately led him to the conclusion that one particular story he had been focusing on the Bible could not possibly be historically accurate. I don't remember what that story was precisely. Maybe it was about the age of the earth. But whatever it was, it just took that one inconsistency to slay his entire faith. His whole religious education, as he saw it, rested on the inerrancy of the Bible. If the Bible could be wrong about one thing, then it could be wrong about many things. And if the Bible could be wrong, how could he trust anything his church had ever taught him? My friend didn't use these words, but I've since heard people describe a loss of faith like that as a kind of spiritual death. Another kind of spiritual death happens when that which has connected us to ourselves, to each other, and the sources of inspiration and meaning that guide our lives dry up and just blow away. That can happen over time to people who become seduced by the siren song of the consumer culture, so that what matters to the person is no longer connections and relationships, but money and things. It can also happen with addictions of various kind when the drink or the drug become the guiding star in a person's life. I think it can also happen with certain kinds of depression. At least it happened to me. In my early 20s, I fell into a severe and debilitating depression, which left me painfully disconnected. My depression lasted for just a little over a year. During that year, summer was the most difficult time. The bright blue days felt like an indictment. All the world seemed happy and at ease, and I was living on Martha's Vineyard, so they also seemed on vacation. And meanwhile, I was working on this incredible farm, but nothing seemed incredible to me, and I struggled every day just to find a reason to get out of bed in the morning. When I finally began to come out the other side, I had a lot of work to do. Spiritually, that work included considering very deeply what I could ultimately count in my life as trustworthy. Depression taught me that I can't always trust myself to get through. Sometimes, I discovered, getting through requires trusting that I'm not alone. Someone else, something not just me. On the other side of depression, I discovered, eventually, not exactly a new faith, but a renewed one. What was a spiritual death became an opportunity for spiritual renewal. Lots of people who have struggled with addictions have testified to the experience of spiritual renewal, spiritual rebirth in their own lives. And many who have lost the faith of their childhoods have discovered a more satisfying, reliable, and mature faith on the other side of that loss. I'm not saying it's always like that, but it can be like that. Like the night when it falls, spiritual losses can often be seen on the other side as the beginning of a new day. So what about another mortality, social death? When Gene suggested this as one of the mortalities to explore, I asked him for a couple of examples. He suggested retirement and Alzheimer's disease as potential examples of social death. At first, I wasn't so sure about the retirement example, mostly because the majority of retired people I know are so happily retired and describe it as a wonderful chapter in their lives. But I knew that previous generations of professional men especially have often described retirement in those terms. I wondered if that was something that the baby boomers' experience of retirement is in the process of changing. But then I discovered an article published in the Chronicle of Higher Education just 2 years ago. The article notes that many colleges and universities have experienced faculty in their 60s and 70s refusing retirement, and that for many, social and emotional concerns are just as important, if not more important, than financial concerns. The article quoted the president of the University of Virginia, who said that retirement for many faculty is like a social death, and even if it isn't, they think that it is. The article went on to describe several ways that universities have found to help prepare older faculty and facilitate a transition to retirement, which helps them maintain meaningful connections to the university if they would like them. The article reminded me that many people experience their workplace not only as the locus of their social lives, but also as a primary source of identity. It turns out that this particular struggle also resonates widely with professional athletes. John Mickles was the Green Bay Packers' top draft choice in 1996. He was poised for a highly successful football career, but just 3 years later, an injury forced him into retirement at the age of 27. It turns out that that's a pretty common experience. The average length of an NFL career is just 4 years. However, the majority of the men who retire from professional football have absolutely no idea what else they might do with their lives. Ken Ruckers is a 12-year Packers veteran who now runs an organization called Games Over, which is dedicated to helping professional athletes transition from professional sports to other careers when they retire. He says that currently 78% of NFL players are either divorced, bankrupt, or unemployed 2 years after retiring. The problem, John Mickles says, is that retirement from football is like a social death, and players have to be able to grieve that loss like a death. That's hard to do when it seems it's always been your identity, when it's always defined your life, he says. Organizations like Games Over and programs like many innovative universities have begun, and a whole spate of books, including several we have in the church library on retirement, are all helping people grieve the end of their professional careers and move on to a new chapter so that retirement can be a satisfying stage of life. I think it's harder to imagine what a new chapter in life might be for a person who has lived into advanced Alzheimer's or some other advanced dementia. We've all heard the horror stories. We've all heard people say that the person that they loved is gone, no longer there, that their body remains, but the mind is gone. Janelle Taylor is a medical anthropologist whose own mother has Alzheimer's. Taylor writes that the litmus question in our society seems to be around recognition. People ask her all the time, she says, does her mother still know who she is? It's been a long time since her mother has spoken her name or acknowledged that she knows how she's connected to her. And yet despite that, her mom is still glad to see her. Taylor visits her mom in her secure dementia unit in a nursing home regularly, but she notices that except for one lifelong friend, she and her siblings are her mother's only visitors. Over the course of her lifetime, her mother developed a large number of friends in a wide variety of settings. However, after her Alzheimer's became apparent, her mother's friends began dropping away. Dementia seems to act as a very powerful solvent on many kinds of social ties, she writes. As a result of their discomfort and lack of knowledge about how to interact with someone who has dementia, many people just back away. The consequences for people with dementia, Taylor writes, is too often a kind of social death, which adds more burden to their struggles. Our story tells us that every nightfall is the beginning of a new day. What kind of new day is possible after advanced memory loss has set in? Taylor writes that though her relationship with her mom has changed dramatically, she has found meaningful ways to connect with her mother and share with her experiences of care and caring that are still accessible to her. To be sure, this kind of connection requires the loved one to learn about dementia and develop new ways of relating. The seminar that we're having in church later this afternoon is designed precisely to offer an introduction to those kinds of skills. The truth is that if we live long enough, we are either likely to experience dementia ourselves or to love someone who does. If those of us with memories intact can learn the skills to care well for our loved ones with dementia, we can be part of transforming their experience of advanced memory loss from social death to new life. It may not be easy, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. Every human being begins life utterly reliant on kindnesses he can neither remember nor repay, writes Taylor. And many of us will end our lives in a similar state. It is only as members of communities that any of us can hope to transcend forgetfulness and death. I think that's another dimension of what it means for us to be a community of memory and of hope. So we've considered spiritual death and social death. We end now with what many people regard as the final end, physical death. Like many Unitarian Universalists, I affirm that the lives of those we have loved live on in us after their own lives have come to an end. And like many Unitarian Universalists, I also regard physical death as the end. I've never believed in any kind of afterlife or reincarnation. Nothing I've experienced or encountered has persuaded me that there's more to come when this life is done. In our conversation, Jean introduced me to the story of Eben Alexander. Alexander has been an academic neurosurgeon for over 25 years, 15 of them at Harvard Medical School. Like me, Alexander used to believe that physical death marked the end of life. But then he had an experience which changed not only his mind, but also his life. Alexander, you may have heard of because he's the author of a best-selling book called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. One morning, Alexander was getting ready for work, and he was struck with sudden severe back pain. Within a couple of hours, he was in a hospital on a ventilator and diagnosed with an extremely rare form of bacterial meningitis. Alexander was in a coma for a week. He explains that while he was in that coma, the meningitis completely shut down his neocortex. His physicians thought that he might never recover. But after a week in a coma, he started to come out of it. He describes that upon coming out of it, his cognitive functioning was still impaired. He remembers coming out of it and remembers not having language, not recognizing the people in the room, not knowing what was going on. At the same time as he came out of the coma, he remembered an experience that he describes as hyper-real and extremely vivid. In a nutshell, he describes that experience as beginning in what he calls an earthworm eye view, in essentially a sea of frothy mud. He says he felt that he had been in that mud for eternity. He had no memory of this universe, of his life in this universe, of language, of his family, of his friends, even of his self. And so there was no distress. He just felt that he was existing in this kind of mud. But then this spinning white orb came to him with a melody that rescued him. He describes it as being rescued. And he was transported to this verdant valley. In the valley, he felt himself to be a speck on a butterfly wing, not an embodied self, but a something else, a speck on a butterfly wing with millions of other butterflies flying around the valley. And on the butterfly wing with him was a beautiful young woman who was communicating to him, not in words, but in other ways, that he was loved, that he was cherished, that he was embraced. He discovered later that through a series of serendipitous events, that young woman was a sister who he had never known because he had been adopted at birth, and the sister had died a few years earlier. The experience he describes has many layers and involves going back and forth between that earthworm eye view and the verdant valley on at least three different occasions. He says he came away from it feeling as though his consciousness had been liberated into a much grander state of experience than he had ever had before. After his near-death experience, immediately afterwards, he decided to study it as a neurosurgeon. And so he wrote a very detailed account of what happened to him and then developed various hypotheses about what possibly could have been happening in his brain that would have allowed for such profound memories. And then he worked through each hypothesis that he developed and came in the end to the conclusion that there is no other explanation other than that there is life beyond this life. Alexander says that he has been going around the country and sharing his experiences with many people, especially with academics, and he says that other neurosurgeons who, after listening to his presentation, have come up to him and said that they agree with his conclusion, that they can see no other way that his brain could have manufactured these memories. Other neurosurgeons have been much more critical of his experience, saying that the memories must not have been generated during the coma, but rather in those moments as he was coming out of the coma and regaining the function of his cortex. Alexander insists that that was not possible because he moved back and forth, as I told you, between that earthworm eye view and the verdant valley on at least three occasions, and he realized that he could help facilitate his return to that verdant valley by recalling the memory that was associated with that spinning orb. So Alexander now believes that the mind can exist separately from the brain, that we can learn meditation and centering prayer techniques which will liberate consciousness from our bodily state, and that another life exists beyond this life here on earth. Alexander's book has been and remains at the top of the bestseller list, along with other titles, including Heaven is for Real, which is the story of a little boy who encountered God in a near-death experience, and To Heaven and Back, which is an orthopedic surgeon's near-death experience. So what are we to make of such stories? Is there life beyond this life? Ultimately, we can't answer that for one another. Personally, I remain unconvinced. Others will read this story, especially the accounts by scientists, and find them compelling, find in them either confirmation of an afterlife or at least compelling evidence to suggest that there might be one. Whatever conclusions we come to about what, if anything, happens beyond physical death, I hope that we can agree that how we approach our deaths in this life matters a great deal. And so I'll leave you with one story about a woman who, after fighting cancer for some time, decided that she was done. She told her children that she wanted to go home so that she could attend to the business of dying. Though she had never been a quilter, she told her children she was going to piece a quilt. Over the next few months, she worked diligently on that quilt. As she selected each piece of fabric, she found that they had stories that they reminded her of. Stories about when she was a girl, about her own parents, about her marriage, about her working life. So many stories rendered verbal through the colors, the textures, the patterns that she was creating in this quilt. These were stories that she wanted to share with her family, memories she wanted to relate, conversations she needed to have, and the quilt enabled her to have them. After she died, her family realized that the quilt had been the means through which she had attended to the business of dying. She had the benefits of time and memory, and she used both to reaffirm her relationships, which had given her life meaning. After she died, her family had not only the quilt, but also all those stories and many more memories. Death sets a thing significant, the poet tells us. How might our lives be fuller and richer if we find a way to really wrestle with that significance before death comes? I leave you with the question. Amen, and blessed be.
Water and ice, birth and death. Today, we mourn the passing of Tom Myers. We welcome Isabel Rose Checkeye. And it reminds me of a song by Harry Chapin called Circle. All my life's a circle, sunrise and sundown. The moon rose through the nighttime till the daybreak comes around. And the circle of life goes on. For all that is wonderful and beautiful in this community, the offering will now be gratefully received.
We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all of our unity, all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth and to the stars. We have gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world.